condition thickened and spread outward, becoming finally a general fog over the whole area. We had come from depthless clear night sky to dense fog in a few minutes. I was frankly amazed. Dennis was the first to offer an explanation, with a certainty that seemed as puzzling as the thing itself.
It's some kind of barometric instability that our burning joint was able to push over some critical threshold.
You must be putting me on. You mean to tell me that the heat of our joints started water condensing into visible fog right near us, and that was like a chain reaction to all of the supersaturated air nearby? Who could believe it? Yes, that's it.
Yes,
and what is more, this is
happening for a reason.
Or rather something.
Maybe the mushroom is using it as an example. It is a way of showing us that small instabilities in the system can trigger large general fluctuations.
This rap of Dennis's was very unsettling to me. I could not imagine that his explanation was correct or exactly what was going on. It passed through my mind then for the first time that he might be spacing out mentally. I used no psychoanalytical jargon in thinking about it, but I noted a reaction in myself to what he said that included the idea that he might be unfolding into a mythopoetic reality. By this time, the fog was impenetrable, and we all retired for the night, but not before Ev related that in the silence before the appearance of the fog, she had had a hallucination with her eyes closed of a strange elf-like creature rolling a complicated polyhedron along the ground. Each facet of this polyhedron seemed, she said, like a window onto another place in time or another world. It's the stone, I breathed, the lapis philosophorum, glimpsed in the Amazonian night, seemingly a great multidimensional jewel in the keeping of a telluric dwarf. The power of the image was deep and touching. I seemed to feel the hopes of the old alchemists, the puffers great and small, who had sought the lapis in the cloudy swirling of their alembics. I had never seen or imagined the mystery of the stone thus, but in listening to Ev's description of what she had seen, an image formed in my mind that to this day remains with me. It is the image of the stone as hyperdimensional jewel become UFO, the human soul becomes starship. It is the universal panacea at the end of time. All history, the shockwave of this final unveiling of the potential of the human psyche. These thoughts, these reveries seemed then like the stirring of something vast, something dimly sensed, stretched out over millions of years. Something about the destiny of mankind and the return of the soul to its awesome and hidden source. What was happening to us? The sense of the peculiar was nearly palpable. Dark oceans of time and space seemed to swell and flow beneath our feet. The image of the Earth hanging in space was everywhere emotionally superimposed on the situation around us. And what was that situation, really? I slept, thrilled and uneasy at the edge of sleep, then deep sleep and deep dreams from which nothing remained in the morning save the sense of yawning interstellar space.
Thank you.
Chapter 8, The Opus Clarified. The morning of March 2nd, 1971, dawned crystalline and hot at La Chorrera. It was the much-anticipated day when Ev, Dennis, and I would at last be able to take possession of the house in the forest that was now finally vacated. There was more than the usual amount of excitement associated with our frequent moves this particular morning. For 3 days, Dennis had been saying that the energy of the phenomenon we were involved with was so great that we should not go any further unless we had the greater isolation that the forest house provided. In all of this recent surge of speculation, our original ethnobotanical intentions had not been completely forgotten. Far from it. Our immediate intent was to use ayahuasca as an MAO inhibitor and a problem-solving drug, and to brew and take the Banisteriopsis capi that Ev and I had gotten from Basilio a few days before. Our move began shortly after dawn in order to avoid the heat of the day. The trek to move ourselves and our equipment to the new home involved going through the pastures, which we had not seen since our mushroom experience 2 days before. The Stropharia seemed to be everywhere. There seemed not to be a cow pie without its golden flush of perfect mushrooms. I promised myself that as soon as we had squared away the new hut and otherwise settled in, that we should again take the mushrooms. As it happened, Ev and I spent the rest of the day following the moose, clearing the ground around the hut and pulling large tree roots out of the sandy soil and stacking them in the sun to dry out and serve as the fuel for the fire we anticipated building in order to brew up our yahe. We seemed to glory in physical exertion. Energy and light seemed to fill everything. Dennis, who had been rather withdrawn and snappish with everyone since his experience and its mixed reception, had wandered down the forest trail in the direction of the Witoto village 13 kilometers away. He had taken his notebook. In the middle of the afternoon, he returned. He was very excited, and he had completed writing out the preliminary notes for what became the experiment at La Chorrera. It was the only written record of his ideas that was actually made at the time, and as such is the only piece of written primary evidence that we have about how we both viewed what we were doing as we were doing it. These notes do not, of course, represent the final form of our theorizing about these matters. Refinement of these ideas has been constant since their creation. These notes are not to be taken at face value at all. The scientific basis of our work is elaborately described in The Invisible Landscape. That work represents our considered composite opinion as of 1975. The present work is the story of the growth of those ideas through time and shows the fallacies and myths spun into the fabric of the first conception of these ideas. But how complete the vision was and how finely worked its detail. The working understanding that is represented in these notes of my brothers are the operational basis of the effect that we did trigger on the 5th of March. His notes were our working myth, and they did have great effectiveness. They are not, however, for the reader faint of heart. They are like the words of a magical incantation. Magicians will wish to linger over them. The rest of us might wish to skim over them and hurry on with what is, even without the theory, a ripping good story.
2 March. Further experiments with the audio warp phenomenon yesterday raise some interesting new questions and enhance our ongoing understanding. I chose the term audio warp because my experience thus far, coupled with what I have been told, leads me to believe that this all has to do with vocally generating a specific kind of energy field which can rupture three-dimensional space. I do not understand if the field is electromagnetic, but it seems to bend space in such a way as to turn it upon itself through a higher dimension. Here is how it is done. One must take enough psilocybin to allow the sound to be audible. This sound we understand to be the ESR of the resonating psilocybin alkaloids within the mushroom. The presence of rapidly metabolizing high-energy tryptamines within the yahe acts as antenna that sensitizes the neural matrix to the spin resonance energy of the Stropharia psilocybin. It is this principle that allows the signal to be made audible. It must then be amplified via the tryptamine admixture antennas to what is felt to be its fullest amplitude. Then, via vocal sound, this energy is placed into the harmine complex within the body and within the mushroom, which has been, in some small part, cooled to absolute zero, the temperature at which molecular vibration ceases through absorption of the psilocybin ESR pulses. Once this ESR wave has been audially detected, it will be possible to amplify it within the neural circuits by channeling it through the harmine complex. That is, by imitating the psilocybin ESR with the voice, causing the amplified sound to strike a harmonic tone with the harmine metabolizing in the brain, thereby exciting the harmine ESR. Since harmine complexes are merely further down the same biosynthetic pathway that converts tryptophan into psilocybin, it is possible to consider the ESR tone of psilocybin as a harmonic overtone of harmine, and vice versa. Using harmonic overtones, it is possible to sound a tone which will cancel one or more of its octaves reflected in harmonic scales above and below it. This is easily demonstrated on a cello. Suppose a tone, say the open string A, is sounded. The sound is a wave vibration of air molecules caused by the string, which acts as a resonator. The tone is heard most loudly in the key in which it was sounded, but it also sounds every other key of A in the octaves above and below it. It is possible to cancel out the original tones by touching the string very lightly at certain harmonic points. When this is done, the overtones in the higher and lower registers become audible. If one understands the theory of harmonic resonators well enough, one can determine which overtones will be resonated if certain points on the string are touched. When this understanding is applied to molecular ESR resonation, it remains essentially the same in principle. When the ESR tone of the psilocybin is heard via tryptamine antenna, it will strike a harmonic tone in the harmine complexes being metabolized within the system, causing its ESR to begin to resonate at a higher level. According to the principles of tonal physics, this will automatically cancel out the original tone, that is, the psilocybin ESR, and cause the molecule to cease to vibrate. However, the ESR tone that sustains the molecular coherency is carried for a microsecond on the overtonal ESR of the harmine complex. This leaves the momentarily electrically canceled and superconductive psilocybin suspended in a low-energy electromagnetic field generated by the harmine ESR. In so doing, it will regain its original, but now superconductively amplified ESR signal, which will permanently lock it into a superconductive state. As this phenomenon proceeds, it will automatically trigger the inverse of the initial process. The psilocybin, superconductively charged by mind, will harmonically cancel the ESR resonance of the harmine within the brain. The energy of the harmine-psilocybin complex ESR will be absorbed instantly into the matrix of the mushroom. This will cause these molecules, metabolizing within the body and bonded to neural DNA, to instantly drop to absolute zero. Clearly, this harmine-psilocybin DNA complex must immediately separate itself from the cellular matrix. There is great danger at this moment, but pathways exist to deal with it. We will find that these molecules condense out of our bodies, accompanied by a sound. This sound will be the harmonic ESR tone of this complex, amplified superconductively and broadcasted frozen into the superconductive matrix of the mushroom. The superconductively charged psilocybin acts as an antenna which picks up the amplified ESR signals of the complex and condenses vibrational signals into a superconductive matrix. The opus can now be briefly summarized. The mushroom must be taken and heard. The yahe must be taken and charged with the overtonal ESR of the psilocybin via voice-imparted amplified sound. The ESR resonance of the psilocybin in the mushrooms will be canceled and it will drop into a superconducting state. A small portion of the physical matter of the mushroom will be obliterated. The superconductively charged psilocybin will pick up the ESR harmonic of the yahe complex. This energy will be instantly and completely absorbed by the higher dimensional tryptamine template. It will be transferred to the mushroom as vocal sound and condensed onto the psilocybin as a bonded complex of superconductive harmine psilocybin DNA. The result will be a molecular aggregate of hyperdimensional superconducting matter that receives and sends messages transmitted by thought, that stores and retrieves information in a holographic fashion in neural DNA, and that depends on superconductive harmine as a transducer energy source, and superconductive RNA as a temporal matrix. This aggregate will be a living and functioning part of the brain of the molecular singer who creates it. It will be composed of higher dimensional matter, that is, matter that has been turned through the higher dimension via the process of canceling its electrical charge with the harmonic vibration, transmitting that vibration across space from superconductive transmitter to superconductive receiver, and then recondensing that vibration onto a superconductive template, the charged psilocybin in the mushroom, until the harmine psilocybin DNA complex condenses into a superconducting molecule. A molecule that is hyperdimensional matter would, by this theory, remain so as long as it remains in a superconducting configuration, probably forever, since it is powered by its own ESR energy. It will then be responsive to commands via endogenous tryptamine ESR thoughts. It will be keyed into our collective DNAs, and it will contain harmine as a superconductive transceiver and power source.
It was his idea, and it seemed to me a magnificent one, that the body is like an undiscovered musical and scientific instrument whose potential lies all around and within us, but of which we are unaware. He said that the mind, through an act of will, could use the singing voice to interact with the brain as though it were a color organ and a holographic library all wrapped into one. Dennis pointed the way toward a kind of Orphic science where the great advances would be made using only the interaction of the quaternity of singing voice, mind, brain, and imagination. More, however, than a chant-induced collective synesthesia was promised. He was saying that the laws of acoustics and low-amperage bioelectrical phenomena could be manipulated to give the experimenter a doorway into exploring states of matter and realms of physics of high energy and low temperature that are currently, at least, supposed to be the exclusive province of researchers totally dependent on extremely technically sophisticated and powerful instruments. It became possible for a moment to dream that the powers of shamanism derived from a millennium-old knowledge of microphysics and bioelectronics that was actually far in advance of our own. Perhaps the shamanic traditions of this planet are the keepers of a path of understanding that uses the human body, brain, mind as its cutting edge, and which leaves the present state of the art which our own scientific method has achieved a very poor second. This is really an old idea, the siren song of Pythagoras, that the mind is more powerful than any imaginable particle accelerator, more sensitive than the most powerful radio or optical telescope, more powerful in its grasp of information than any computer, that the human body, its organs, its voice, its power of locomotion, and its imagination is a more than sufficient means to the exploration of any place, time, or energy level in the universe. It was this idea that he would set out to prove, to realize in the actual hardware of this dimension, a roving lenticular vehicle which he was convinced could be generated out of his own body DNA and things present at hand in the Amazonian environment, the mushroom and the ayahuasca. Chapter 9, A Conversation Over Saucers. As Dennis came into the camp that afternoon, he hailed me excitedly. He thrust his notes into my hands, and I read what you, dear reader, have just also read. And I felt the themes of the strange place we had come to crystallize. I felt again the sense of something in the sky, calmly omniscient but closely observing us. I returned to the beginning and read it all over again. I had no basis whatsoever to judge what I was reading. My brother's scientific speculation seemed to have acquired a life of its own. He was like a great all-knowing computer. Indeed, later this theme would emerge even more explicitly. I listened to him explain his idea. He was very deeply into it. Ideas were coming out of him like spaghetti out of a rasher. Thousands of words about all these strange things. He said, "You know what we could do?" And then he laid down the rap, which is now enshrined as the central doctrine of the opus. He called it hypercarbolation, something that you can do using different kinds of vocal sounds. For instance, if you pluck a string, it will sound in the octave in which it is struck, but it will also sound in octaves above and below its key. It has what are called harmonic overtones. If you strike the chord and then quench it, you can hear the harmonic overtones. It was something which had fascinated Pythagoras. Dennis pointed out to me that one can use two sounds to cancel a sound if they are exactly the same in relation to each other. This same principle can be used to still molecular motion. In very localized areas, one can produce low temperatures with audio cancellation. Dennis felt he had figured out a way to do something using psychoactive compounds, psilocybin, the tryptamine complex, and then the harmala compounds, the beta-carbolines which occur in yahe. He said that if you look at the molecules of the progressive cyclicizing of the beta-carboline family, what you find is that the electron spin resonance of these molecules moving from one to the other is in fact a harmonic overtone. This is interesting because Claudio Naranjo reported that 50% of his subjects that took harmine in Chile reported a buzzing in the head. It was not associated with other kinds of psychedelics. It seemed to be uniquely associated with these harmine compounds. The Jivaro shaman also report a buzzing in the head. Dennis' idea was that when one takes yahe, when it is metabolizing through one's neural matrix in the brain, a sound is heard. This is a complicated theory about the enzyme dynamics by which one is able to hear this sound, but that is the gist of it. Not all compounds have an electron spin resonance. They have to have a free ring. All compounds with a free ring will resonate. The hallucinogens we were interested in have free rings, and DNA is also able to resonate. It is a phenomenon of molecular structure. During the process of metabolizing the alkaloids in yahe, a relationship is formed with the tryptophan metabolites in the brain. A sound is heard that is characteristic of the interaction. Once the sound is heard, it can be imitated. What you have is a vocal sound. Dennis insisted he could do things with this sound. He said that he would be in effect emitting an amplified spin resonance, an amplified ESR modulated sound that he would hear coming from these compounds in his brain. Making this sound would set up a series of harmonic vibrations above and below it in other compounds also metabolizing in the brain. Now, from this theoretical basis, he took flight. When he cancels the sound, if he is in the correct relationship to the molecule he is directing sound at, its temperature will drop. Of many millions of this kind of molecules struck by this sound, a few dozen or hundreds will be in the correct geometrical relationship, and they will be frozen out, their molecular motion stilled, nearly instantly. Now, a peculiar property of low temperatures is that very high bonding energies appear. A molecule close to absolute zero will bond to anything. It forces its way into the structure. The harmine molecule, which is analogous to a little bell, gives a bell-like chiming sound. If we come on it right and cancel it, there is neural DNA active in the brain. The electrical configuration of harmine is enough like the molecular configuration of adenine, one of the bases in DNA, that it will replace it. It will bond through into the chain, and when it is bonded in, it has a ring. It's the same size as adenine, but it's slightly more complicated. It is a free resonance ring. He paused and then gathered his thoughts to continue. Now, the normal ESR of harmine is a simple signal, but the electron spin configuration of DNA is very, very complicated. It's a broad band. When the harmine goes in there, it will cease to broadcast its own resonation because it will have become very tightly bonded into the overstructure of the macromolecule. It will instead begin to broadcast the ENR resonation of the DNA. That's it. If you have followed this far, the rest is easy. DNA is what you are. The physical form is just a lot of juicily expressed reflections of enzymes set in motion and coded by DNA. Neural DNA is known to be non-metabolizing. It does not go away. The meat on your body comes and goes every year. Your skeleton is not the same one you had 5 years ago, but neural DNA is an exception. It is there for all time. You come into the world with it. It records. It's like a storage place for memory. Not only our personal memory, but any entity or organism which has DNA in it. There is a way to find a connection to it. This is it. You put a radio into the DNA, and this ESR resonation will begin to flood your system because the bond will be permanent. There will be no way to disrupt it. It will tell you everything, everything that can be known in the world of space and time, because it contains your own and everyone else's records. We are all connected through this magical substance, which is what makes life possible, and which causes it to take on its myriad forms. All DNA is the same. It is the settings that are different. You get butterflies, mastodons, or human beings, depending on the settings. Or so you say, was my non-committal reply. For the moment, I simply did not know what to say. He stared at me, clearly expecting more. I believed in the infinite self-transforming power of the human mind and species, and I could suppose that there are parallel worlds and alternative dimensions. I could imagine any number of science fiction possibilities, provided I was not asked to believe that I was about to be personally present at their discovery or unleashing. But this is what he was saying, that we had somehow stumbled upon or been led to the trigger experience in the human world that would transform the ontological basis of reality so that the mind and matter would become the same thing and reflect the human will perfectly. How could anyone conceive of such a thing? We had come to La Chirera with a belief that if life and mind are possible, then the mysteries of the universe might well be inexhaustible. Something very passive, yet ever-present, was there, elaborating these ideas in our minds, something that we had thought of for some days as the mushroom. We talked several hours about these ideas, and what finally emerged was the idea that we needed a test, or at least Dennis maintained that a partial test of this idea could be undertaken to convince me. He thought that as the superconducting state became voice-stabilized, there should be a marked lowering of temperature in the immediate area. In our talking, we had left the area of the hut and drifted down the forest path. It would be possible to attempt to generate the effect of coolness right there on the spot, he supposed. We seated ourselves on the sandy path facing each other, with the afternoon sun on both of us. After a couple of preliminary low mechanical buzzes, Dennis made a sound very similar to the sound that he had unleashed in the Knoll house 3 days before. This sound had an extremely peculiar quality, and as it rose in intensity, I looked down at the hairs on my arms and saw them rise as goose flesh formed and a wave of intense shivering swept over me. To him to stop. He stopped instantly and seemed much drained by the effort. I was quite disoriented. I frankly could not tell whether a real wave of very cold air had swept over me, or whether the particular sound had somehow made my body react as though it were being exposed to cold air. It was not lost on me that if the effect had truly generated a blast of cold air, then it had violated the known laws of physics. No, that was not lost on me. But I did not care to experiment further. The whole thing had an eerie aura about it, and if the effect was real, who knew what could come of pushing it too far? I was more confused than ever by my enigmatic brother and his burgeoning ideas and abilities. The whole thing seemed absurd, and yet very compelling, like a hypnotic game into which one becomes absorbed in spite of oneself. We returned to our camp and mentioned to all present that Dennis had generated the wave of cold air that he had predicted from the theory, but it was all sufficiently ambiguous that no one felt drawn to comment. It was already quite clear that two camps were emerging, one that wished no further part in these matters, whatever their validity, and one reflecting our own opinion that cautious experiment was indicated. A commonality of language was breaking down. After dinner, Vanessa and Dave returned to the Riverside house, and the three of us settled into our first night in the forest since arriving at La Chorrera. Dennis was in a state of continual activity, amplifying his ideas and trying out new wrinkles on us. He retired into a world of very intense activity. He wrote his ideas over and over, the steps to do it and the theory of why it should work. He was spending lots of time alone writing, or he would come back and talk to us. He was on to something very strange. His word pictures caused reality to shimmer and wrinkle at the edges. He was really in touch with this bubbling obsidian fourth dimensional fluid that we were going to bond into a usable tool and end history. And go to the stars. Was fine, we'll try it. The atmosphere was drenched with the bizarre. Now we had arrived at the center of the Amazon, and we could feel something in the sky watching. We were happy heads trying to explore one last fairy tale, so we could be rationalists forever, and now we had come out here to encounter something enormous, something alive and very old and very strange, something peculiar in the extreme. I was quite uncreative in this period. I was taking the mushroom. I was ecstatic all the time. I would simply sit and listen to Dennis rave. It went beyond anything anyone I knew had ever dreamed of. We had set the evening of March 4th as the day we would test the full theory of the harmine DNA bond. I noted with unusual satisfaction that this day corresponded with an idiotic pun that had stuck with me since earliest childhood. What day of the year is a command? Answer, March 4th. How fitting, then, I ranted and raved, how fitting that we will attempt to concretize the soul on that day. Absurdly, the coincidence of the date with that pun seemed part of a universal secret plan, unraveling to bring us to the history-culminating moment when man would march into a higher dimension. My own thoughts seemed to me to be nothing like the super-scientific theory formation that my brother was involved in. I was baffled by much of what was going on. I amused myself constructing a pipe out of the strange heart-shaped fruits that we had otherwise given up as inedible. From one of those fruits and a hollow reed and a bit of river clay, I constructed a water pipe that gave me great satisfaction. While the jargon of the ESR biophysicist whirled around me, I contemplated what I had achieved with two plants and a bit of mud. It seemed to me a marvel of ingenuity, and because the fruit was so strange, there was something about it vaguely unearthly. This pipe might have been fashioned from one of the fruits that gentle Weena offered the time traveler in Wells' epic. It was a weird and haunting object, and when it was smoked, the bubbling of the water beneath the thick rind sounded very like the beating of some great mammalian heart. Even Dennis paused to admire this pipe, and we determined that it would be used in our experiment when the moment came to smoke some of the Banisteriopsis capi bark to boost the harmine levels in our blood. We were operating in a world where scientific method, ritual, and participation mystique were inseparably intertwined, inseparably because our own minds and bodies were to be the retorts of the psychoalchemical transformation that we were experimenting with. That day, March 3rd, we all pulled roots and stacked them in the sun. It seemed the most satisfying activity imaginable. Nothing could have seemed more right. That evening we made a tape of our intentions, but unfortunately our tape recorder was not in good working order, and that tape has proven impossible to salvage. It is a loss to be regretted, since the emotional content of what we were experiencing would come across most clearly from our own words. The taping session ranged over a number of themes. Hypercarbolation, for such we had named the process of altering the neural DNA and changing a human being into an eternal hyperdimensional being. Hypercarbolation, for such we had named the process of altering the neural DNA and changing humanity into an eternal hyperdimensional being. Hypercarbolation, for such we had named the process of altering the neural DNA and changing humanity into an eternal hyperdimensional being. Hypercarbolation, for such we had named the process of altering the neural DNA and changing man into an eternal hyperdimensional being. It was a process that we imagined associated with sexual generation. We spoke of it as the birth of an idea, in a sense whose literalness is not easy to convey to minds that have not brushed with schizophrenia. We hoped that mind, driven by will to the good, could enter into the process of generation and guide it toward the production of the imagination-modulated resurrection body, so dear to Origen and modern UFO enthusiasts. The dead. We believed that hypercarbolation was to be the shamanic defeat of death, that those doorways the dead enter through daily were finally to be thrown open to a hypercarbolated humanity that would then have freedom of movement to and from an eternity in which the species was a living reality. The presence of our dead mother, or Carl Jung, Newton and Bruno, Pythagoras and Heraclitus, was an overwhelming and all-inclusive intuition that we shared and could not ignore. There seemed to be an ideological lineage whose task was the shattering of the historical continuum through the generation of the living lapis of hypercarbolated humanity. All these visionary thinkers had worked on their part of this project, Now, as the secret work of human history, the generation of Adam's cosmic body lost since paradise, neared completion, these shades stirred and pressed near to our Amazonian campsite as we became the human atoms critical to the inception of the transformation of man into a galaxy-roving bodhisattva, the culmination and quintessence of the highest aspirations of spawning, star-coveting humanity. The psychologist will recognize this as a description of messianic ego inflation. Such it is, but we felt these things as anyone would feel them if they truly believed themselves to be in the position that we believed ourselves to be in. We wondered, why us? To such questions, the mushroom spoke in my mind without hesitation. Because you have diligently sought the good, and because you trusted no human being more than yourself. The emotional impact of these sorts of exchanges was intense beyond anything I have ever experienced. I felt humbly grateful to the point of tears. I felt exalted. We wanted to salvage paradise for humanity, and we thanked all gods and nature that our eccentric quest, out of all the lives and paths being lived on the earth, was placed by fate to be so near the cutting edge. Where the elder shamanism had failed, we would succeed. The rescue of the timeless pearl of human immortality from the well of death would, through the act of hypercarbolation, become a living reality for every person who had ever lived. All the pain and suffering and war and desperation would somehow be replayed and made right through the intercession of the mystery of higher dimensions and backward-flowing time. The wave of understanding that had been gaining since the 27th of January was now about to crest. The wave was so strong as to be nearly visible in everything around us. The lenticular shape of the approaching lapis seemed to be everywhere that I looked. Every shape and form around me was pregnant with its unearthly, opalescent depths. Before our small party of fellow explorers, Dennis and I wept and exulted, addressing the living and the dead with equal candor, saying things that should have been said years before, and things that could not have even been imagined only hours before. We knew that we were behaving bizarrely and were highly emotional, but the intensifying wave of understanding that had gathered itself around us explained all of this. It was, we were assured and assured each other, because ahead of us in time the experimental attempt at hypercarbolation had already succeeded. So many lines of probable fate were sweeping toward the staggering moment of culmination that its inevitability was already sending shock waves and distorted images of the millennium crashing backwards through time. Dennis recently reminded me that I assured all present that so inevitable had our experiment become that if we did not tend the fire and brew the yahe, then these things would be done by themselves. Dry wood rustling out of the forest, gathering itself into the ring of firestones and there to burst into flames. The yahe spontaneously shredding and immersing itself in the waiting pot of water. At the time, this was an easy extrapolation from the hurricane of shamanic gnosis and synchronistic coincidences that was both confirming our success to come and at the same time distorting the very ontological basis of our reality as the inevitable choro of time and necessity narrowed around us and the black hole of the hypercarbolation attempt strengthened its grip on us and drew us with ever-increasing inevitability toward the singularity in time where an unimaginable transformation awaited all on our planet.